Space Force.
Yep. This is episode 38.
You've got a real attitude problem, McFly. You're a slacker.
Yo, what's going on? This is Ego and Vice, episode 38. My name is Mike, as always, and I'm happy to be back. We have a special edition of Ego and Vice, if you will. I do cover a lot of local music and just music in general, but this week I had a very fun thing that I was doing. A girl named Kirsten Kozlowski came into Southwood Studio, and she interviewed me for a documentary that she has been plugging away at painstakingly for the last couple of years. It is a documentary about a bar in Thunder Bay, Ontario called Crocs and Rolls, a place that I know very well, that I spent most of my young life in, played my very first show there, probably played my very last show in Thunder Bay there. I don't know. I can't remember. It's all a blur. But that place is very near and dear to me. And Kirsten has been compiling interviews and footage and just talking to people that went through this bar, which was, how do you call it? It was a must play or a must go to. It was like the center of the universe. We had a funny joke how Thunder Bay is not the it's not the butthole of Canada, but it's the bum crack. And if you're going through Canada, you have to go through the bum crack, and Crocs and Rolls was always there. And back in the 90s, it was this amazing spot to see bands, to play shows, you name it, from the Tragically Hip to Furnace Face to, God damn it, SNFU, The Smalls, Deadbeat Backbone. Man, I could go on and on and on of the people that came through. Rancid played this place in Thunder Bay. It was just little kind of dive bar, in the north core of Thunder Bay. And, you've probably heard of it. If you're somehow affiliated in music or whatever, you've probably heard some musicians who have been around or old fuckers like me who have been, you know, go up to them and mention Crocs and Rolls and they will know what it is. And she had a lot of great experiences there when she was a kid. Growing up, she decided to make a film about it, a documentary about it, and I think that is the fucking coolest thing. And she got a hold of me probably a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, I think, just to kind of tell me about, like, what was happening, and, you know, if I had any footage of us playing there, my old band, I Refuse. And I said, yeah, absolutely I do. And she asked me if I wanted to be interviewed for the actual documentary. And I said, absolutely, I'd love to tell some stories about this bar, because it was a very, very influential and very, very important part of my life. And it was a very important part of a lot of people's lives. And one of the most important things, most important people that is brought up during this conversation with Kirsten is the heart and soul of Crocs and Rolls, Mr. Frank Lafredo, who has been there ever since he was a kid, man. He was like 23 years old, and he started this, turned this family restaurant into this mecca of Canadiana independent music. And not just independent, but just music in general. And Kirsten's going to explain a lot of her experiences with Frank, and she's going to tell some stories. And I'm just proud to be part of this, because not only is it from my hometown, Thunder Bay, Ontario, But it's also nice to be recognized, not just being from Thunder Bay and having spent time there, not recognized myself, but recognized in the same group of people that that bar meant so much to. And I'm honored and I'm flattered and I'm privileged to have talked to Kirsten and been a part of her documentary. Whatever makes the movie, I don't know. If you listen to the very intro music of Ego and Vice, Crocs and Rolls is actually mentioned right in the name. Because, like I say, it was the first place I ever played. That's where I learned to play. Crocs and Rolls is where I learned to play. That's the line. So, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to talk anymore because Kirsten basically tells it all. And, yeah, man. I'm going to play a tune. I don't know what I'm going to play yet, but I'm going to play something that has to do with the 90s and has to do with independent music and maybe something I heard at Crocs. On the other side of this, we're going to come back with Kirsten, and she's going to tell us all about her film and talk about old stories of the Empire, which I'd like to think it is. That is the legacy of Crocs and Rolls in Thunder Bay, Ontario. So we'll see you on the other side. Hey, welcome back. This is Ego and Vice, episode 38. And as you heard in the intro, I have a very special guest in Southwood Studio tonight. Her name is Mrs. Kirsten Kozlowski.
Perfect.
And she is on a voyage, I suppose, creating this amazing documentary about a band, about a bar called Crocs and Rolls from our hometown, Thunder Bay, Ontario, as you heard. But let's just get into it. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have you here. We have been planning this interview for you to come in and talk to me about my experiences at Crocs and Rolls. And the day finally came.
I know. I'm here. I'm so excited.
I know. It was so fun. Like going back and forth through emails and whatnot. And then you showed up and we just finished the interview. And I said to you, hey, I have this podcast. And I would love for you to sit in on the podcast and just talk about the documentary. Talk about your experiences in Thunder Bay. Talk about your experiences at Crocs and Rolls. And let's just have a conversation.
All right, let's do it.
All right, let's start with Thunder Bay. So you're born and raised?
I am. I am a Northwood kid.
So am
I have lived there and I have moved back. And that's where the whole start of this whole voyage, or as I like to call it, Everest, of a documentary kind of started.
Is that the working title of the documentary?
Yeah, it's Crocs and Rolls, Everest.
Everest.
But actually the original, okay, so a little backstory.
Sure.
So about 10 years ago, I was working as a music journalist in Calgary, Alberta.
Okay.
So I was a freelance music journalist, later became an editor, and I was doing a lot of reporting on bands that were coming through playing the West Coast and the weeklies in Vancouver and Alberta and things like that. So what happened when I became an editor is I started to have to talk to a lot of publicists and record labels in part of my job. And the thing about Calgary is that it's a very transient city. Everyone in Calgary is from somewhere else. So the first question anybody asks you is like where you're from.
Okay.
So I would be talking to these people, trying to, you know, do my job, set up interviews for reporters and writers. And as soon as I said Thunder Bay, they would be like, oh, wait a second. Thunder Bay. So you've been to Crocs. You know Crocs, right?
Really? Eh? Just like that?
Just like that. And it happens.
Immediate association. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you're from Thunder Bay, Crocs and Rolls. And so this happened so much when I was like at my job. Uh-huh. That I started to think like there was a story there that was a little bit bigger than just like my hometown hangout, like venue, music venue that I used to go to. That sure. There was something about this place that sort of eclipsed Thunder Bay a little bit and maybe was a bigger story. So I found myself moving back to Thunder Bay and stayed there for about 5 years. And this idea just would not go away.
The idea of doing a documentary or telling the story of Crocs and Rolls.
Right. It was like, I had this idea, like it was either going to be a book or a film or something, but there was that idea that just would not go away. But I was living in the wrong province to do anything about it. So as luck would have it, my husband got a job. We moved back to Thunder Bay. Mm-hmm. And and then I thought, well, you know what? I'm here and I'm just going to see if Frank would be into the idea. Like, is Frank gonna... And I hadn't talked to Frank for, like, 20 years.
Frank is the owner of Crocs and Rolls.
Frank Lefredo.
He's the... It's his fault.
It is his fault. It really is. So I thought, well, okay, I'll go approach Frank and see if what he'd think. And the first thing that he said was, you're totally nuts, Kirsten. Like, don't you have anything better to do in your life than, like, want to do the story? And it actually was his wife, Leola, who... convinced him in the end to do it, because she said, like, not too many people have done anything in their life where somebody wants to archive it for you. So it is something that's important. And what's been really cool is over the last 2 years of like making this, mm-hmm. Seeing Frank sort of see his life. It,
sure.
You know, it's like he... with every interview I get or with people I talk to, and he's involved, like he's a promoter. He helps put me in contact with people. He's starting to see like what his influence really was. And I think maybe that has sort of changed over the last few years.
Great. You're doing it. Let's back that up a little bit.
Sure.
Though.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Crocs and Rolls and your experience when you lived in Thunder Bay when you were a kid. Like, why do you give a shit?
Okay, well, here we go. I started going to Crocs and Rolls. I'd I was 14 turning 15, and I was actually dared by a friend of mine who had been going to the club, and he said, you know what, Kurt, and I was like a nerdy kid. Okay, you have to understand, this is Thunder Bay, 1987.
Oh, I get it.
And I looked like Jerry Seinfeld. I had no style. I didn't even know what I was doing. I was pretty much one of those kids who just didn't want it to be invisible, right? I just wanted to just blend in, not, you know, lift my head. I was just really super shy. And my friend who I had met in, I don't know, Christian living class of
sorry,
all things.
Sorry, that's my fault. Keep
yeah,
going,
no
please.
Problem. So this friend of mine actually dared me to go. And it was, he had to actually dare me quite a bit. He said, you're going to love this club. You're going to love it. Just trust me on this. Mm-hmm. So I remember raiding my parents'
liquor couch. Cabinet.
Well, no, because I was a really big nerd. I actually had to find loose change because I had to catch the bus across town.
Okay. The crosstown.
The crosstown bus.
From Northwood to PA.
Yeah. And it was Halloween, so it was snowing.
I know these things.
Yeah. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't have the right clothes. So I turned my Club Monaco sweatshirt inside out because I thought that was punk rock, you know?
Good start.
And I went and I walked in and the Dayglo Abortions were playing. It was my first show ever. And I just remember walking in, seeing Frank sitting there on the stool at the cash box. And he was only 23, but he looked like an adult person.
A grown ass man. Yeah,
he really was. And it was so I didn't know what to do. So I remember I was standing there like I didn't know what to do. I didn't even think I had enough for the cover. Like I didn't have the full $5. And he just looked at me and he nodded me in. And like, that was it. That was my first interaction with Frank. Like he did the nod, like go on in. And I walked into Crocs by myself. I can't even believe I did it, being the kind of kid that I was. And there were the Dayglo Abortions in their makeshift.
Did the drummer have a tutu on?
Yes, he
Jesus
did.
Bonehead. The drummer was named Jesus Bonehead. I remember a Dayglo Abortion show when I was a kid. I may have been the first time I ever saw them. Cretan was on stage, whatever, and I remember Jesus Bonehead was wearing just the tutu, no shirt, no pants, and he stood up on his drum stool, and he like mooned the crowd, but because he was like this gross, greasy old dude, his like sack was like literally hanging down to his knees, and everyone was just like, I remember the whole crowd was just like, oh, I don't know if that was the show you saw.
You know what? They were wearing, I remember it was Halloween, so they had to come up with a costume. So they had wrapped themselves in toilet paper and they were mummies. Yeah. So that's what they were doing. But I was at that show where they were in the tutu. yeah. It seems to be like his look. And I just remember just sort of being sort of stunned. And I remember in the crowd, like everyone was dressed up and they were all dressed from like Clockwork Orange costumes. Mm-hmm. And I remember tree planters coming by and you know, taking pity on me. Okay. And bringing me to their table. And I just knew from that moment that everything before that had changed for me. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew I wasn't going back to ballet class.
Right.
And I knew I really
even though he had a tutu on?
Even though he had a tutu on, it was not the kind of tutus that I had been wearing. And I knew that something about music and something about being part of that had changed for me.
So Crocs immediately had a huge impact on your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
From that night, was that like your staple? Was that the place you'd go? Or
yeah, all the time. Like that is where we would go. And it's crazy to think this now, but I would go there with friends. I would go there by myself. I would see shows, you know, I would dance or I would sit at the back or I would sit with the band. Like I remember like somehow sitting beside the Rio Statics one night and just like kind of hanging out with them. I just remember it was sort of like, I always say this about Crocs. It was like a church, a youth hostel and a punk rock club, you know, and it was that thing for so many people. It was, I never felt scared. I never felt like I was going to, I don't know, be
like singled out,
ridiculed. Yeah. And it didn't matter if I was alone or with other people. I felt like safe. And, you know, it was funny because I didn't even realize until maybe a few years ago that there was even security at Crocs. I don't remember anybody getting in fights, or I think there was two people thrown out maybe of the bar for being drunk. But you have to understand, too, like being a woman growing up in Thunder Bay, you know, walking down the street by yourself sometimes at night was unpleasant. And being accepted into a counterculture, which I think maybe other scenes, maybe it wasn't the same for them. But there was a real no bullshit policy with Frank. Girls to the front, like, was something that he never wanted anybody to feel like they didn't belong. And maybe that's why everybody feels like Crocs was really like their rec room, their place where they can go.
Yeah, no, I can completely relate. Crocs and Rolls was a safe haven for me. It was a place that we could go and just be ourselves, you know what I mean? And even if, like, you're younger and you're awkward and you don't know where you fit in and whatever, I remember those days very fondly of going to Crocs and, like you just said, just feeling welcome. And it's like, these are my people.
Yeah.
Type of thing.
For sure.
And the environment. It wasn't just the people that were in the bar. It was the environment of the bar itself.
Absolutely.
Which really gave you that sense of being, sense of self, sense of like, okay, you know, I don't fit in with like the jocks and the cheerleaders, and even though you were one.
I was, but I had a shaved head, and we could actually talk about that if you want, but yeah, no.
Yeah, but even though you are something, it doesn't mean you have to be that person, right? And then exactly. you find your element, and you find the people, and Crocs and Rolls was like that for a lot of people, as you've discovered since you've been doing this documentary. You've gone across Canada, can we say that?
I would say Ontario, and then we're doing like Skype interviews with people that live in New York, with people from Vancouver. It's across, you know what it is? Crocs really is sort of the focal point of a larger story about Canadian independent music. And because like you were saying during our interview, it was sort of like this center point. And no matter where, if you were a band touring, especially in those pre-internet days, right? You had to go through Thunder Bay whether you wanted to or not.
It's the bum crack of Ontario.
It really is. And, you know, I mean, I think Frank, because he's just a really humble guy, always says like it was he was just in the right geographic location. Like bands had to come and stay. And he had this Italian restaurant with his brother. And, you know, it was really like, you know, sort of this right time, right place kind of thing for him. But the thing about that is it didn't have to sort of be so successful. Just because you have an Italian restaurant in the middle of Canada and bands have to play there doesn't mean that they want to. And the story really comes down to the question of why people feel so connected. When we were talking to Sookie and Lee in Toronto last year,
Ex Much Music VJ,
yes, and singer,
I remember her.
Yeah, she sang, her band was Bob's Your Uncle. They played there many times. They were a West Coast band, and they were playing back and forth many times. She didn't, you know, like, she wanted to play at Crocs and Rolls, and she remembers that time being one where she was taken care of too. So a lot of these bands who are just like road warring through Canada and usually not in the best vehicle, not at the best time of the year to be doing that, having a place where you can go and not just play but get fed, offered a place to stay in a warm bed and be picked up, driven around, shown, like, you know, the sights of Thunder Bay,
the Sleeping Giant and the Polka Dot Pagoda.
Exactly. But
that's about all there is, folks.
Exactly. But these bands, like people like Dave Bedini, Sookie and Lee, Dave Ulrich, these musicians that we've been talking to, they always say like it was the hospitality of Frank and the fact that they knew when they were going to Crocs that they were going to be getting taken care of. And I think when people think of touring musicians, and you know this from firsthand experience, I don't think audience members or people realize like it is a grueling experience. You are traveling, you're unloading and loading in gear and loading out gear, and then you're expected to go up on stage and play. So to have a place where Frank could offer them food, usually spaghetti his mom had cooked and fed family style, and to be put up in a band house and to be treated with a certain amount of respect, seems to have really touched a chord with a lot of these bands.
Yeah, for sure. And I agree with that 100%. I've toured across Canada, and I know that there's been some great times and there's been some fucking shitty times where you like sleep in the dirt. And,
yeah.
But that's what you do. And if Crocs offered that around that time, let's play a song at this point. Remember back from when you were a kid, you were that, that kid that, wasn't sure if she should go in, but then you, did. Why don't we play a Diglo Abortion song?
I would love to hear Diglo Abortion.
Let's do that. What would you like to hear?
You know what? I'm going to let you pick and, pick whatever you want. I'm going to let you DJ this.
I am going to go with a song, which is probably a common one, but I really, really like it when I was a kid because it was very crunchy and it was pretty awesome. This is the Diglo Abortions. This is a song called Drugged and Driving. drugged and driving by the Dayglo abortions. Okay. So we've kind of touched on your history back in Thunder Bay when you first went to Crocs and Rolls, started kind of, you know, being a kid, yep. just getting comfortable there. You met Frank. We touched a little bit on when you started to get the idea of making the documentary. What happened the day when you woke up, rolled out of bed, looked in the mirror and said, you know what? I'm going to fucking do this.
You know what? We had just finished shooting our second. It was funny. I ended up doing a documentary when we first moved to Thunder Bay. And I had just finished my second documentary about a heavy metal boot hockey team. And I was like, okay, so that one was for my husband because he grew up in Westport and these guys in this boot hockey team were like his idols.
Westport Tavern. Shout out.
Yeah. And they were Westport. So I started to think about like, again, like the story about doing it. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like, I don't know what it was. It was like, ever have those moments where you sort of just have an epiphany one day and you kind of
fewer think, and far between these days, but yes.
Yeah. And you kind of, you do wake up and you think, well, I'm just going to do it. And it was like, I decided I was just going to give him a phone call mm-hmm. and see like what he would do. And yeah, that moment was really scary for me because I guess I hadn't talked to him in about 20 years.
Frank, you're talking
Frank,
about.
Okay. Frank Lafredo.
Yep.
And I was really nervous and I wasn't sure if he would go for it because he had just started Crocs, the second version. Because Crocs had closed down in 96 and he had been sort of out of it for about 10 years. So I didn't know if he even wanted this to happen. So I decided to just go for coffee with him. One day.
So when you decided to actually put some legs on this, like yeah. when was this?
That would be, I'm going to say it was 2014.
Okay. So about 4 years ago.
Yeah. We've been in pre-production for this movie or we've been planning this film for about 5 years.
Okay.
And then it even goes back further, like another five. So the whole idea for this film was about a 10-year sort of passion project for me. In a lot of ways.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I just decided, you know, I've been doing these stories, documentary stories that sort of focus on Northern Ontario and the people who live there, but like told from a different way. So I like to tell stories that are character driven and about something that tells a different sort of way of life or how people live. And sure. it just happened to sort of be all about these Thunder Bay or Northern Ontario characters. And I thought, you know what, if I don't do this, you know, if I don't do the story that I think I'm supposed to do, I mean, I was a music journalist for a long time. That's how I made my living. I was a music fan for like more than half my life.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't make the documentary that I think I'm supposed to, then I'm just going to be kicking myself. And I thought, you know what, now I have the skills to do it. I have two under my belt. And now I just have to kind of like get some courage, you know, about it.
So this is the true labor of love is what it is.
Absolutely. And it
coming from a really genuine place. Like this is, I'm going to do this because I love this place.
Yeah.
I love that dude.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And you know, Frank's a really humble guy and he really doesn't think that he has done anything or like, you know what I mean? Like he's pretty modest guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he's impacted, like there's no way that I would have gone into music journalism as a woman from Northern Ontario and thought that I could write about and talk to major rock stars and do it for a living if it hadn't been for Frank. Because like that whole idea of like feminism and, you know, throwing yourself out there into the world, like that just did not exist for me in Thunder Bay. He gave me, Frank really did show me another way to live my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know what, if he did that for me back then, I'm going to like get that courage and go do it now because somebody has to tell this story. And for me, it really is about, it's a testament to Frank, this film. It's a love, his love of independent music and community and what that really means. I think we say these words a lot. They're like catchphrases and sounds really good. you know, but he's lived this life for so long and has been such an important figure to so many.
Well, I can speak from my point of view, and whether he knows it or not, the way he had structured that bar and the experiences I had as a kid there, whether he knows it directly or indirectly, he influenced a lot of bands, a lot of people, like not just the bigger bands he brought in who were already established, but the younger bands like myself who just had were given the opportunity, right? Yeah. And
so many bands have said too, like if it wasn't for Crocs and Rolls and Frank, like they wouldn't have made it to the other side of the country. They would have given up. And what I didn't realize when I started is that Thunder Bay and Crocs and Rolls was the first stop for a lot of bands just starting out on their tour. Mm-hmm. I talked to Dave Bedini last summer, and Thunder Bay and playing at Crocs was their first show out of Toronto.
Right.
You know, and, you know, I think maybe that's why, like, it resonates with people so much, because it was the beginnings for a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And Frank is still there, and he's still supporting people. I mean, he used to turn down, and these are stories that I think are almost like urban legend. So there's a story of him turning down Soundgarden because he wanted the Bourbon Tabernacle Choir to play that day. He would always put local bands like yours on bills with like high profile like acts that would come through just to help give a leg up to new artists in his hometown. Mm-hmm. And he was doing all of this. Like, I don't think he was like, do you remember him ever not being at Crocs? Like, he worked there all the
time. Not really. He was always lumbering around.
Yeah, he was always there. And I think when you're a kid and you're trying to figure out like where you're supposed to be mm-hmm. in this world, he was probably the most consistent thing in my life for a really long time.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And as the production of the movie or the creating of the movie began, or the documentary, you've been all over Canada. You've been at this for a long time, as you said. Can you tell us some of the people that you've reached out to and some of the interviews that you've sat down with?
Yeah, well, like I mentioned, we've sat down with Sookie and Lee, Dave Bedini. They're from Sookie and Lee's from Bob's Your Uncle. Dave Bedini is kind of a national treasure at this point with the Rio Statics. Dave Ulrich from the Inbreds. We've talked to the members of Furnace Face. We are going to be doing an amazing Toronto shoot coming up in August that like people like Mel Havoc.
Oh, wow.
We're going to be talking to Cowboy Junkies, nice. Skydiggers, Biff Naked. Like, pretty much when I put out the call, I didn't really expect to get that response, because when you do this sort of thing, you're doing like, you're just throwing it out there and seeing what's going to stick. Mm-hmm. And everybody who I've asked has agreed to sit with me or at least share stories or do phoners if they're away in Europe doing tours. And I think that just speaks volumes about the kind of person Frank was, that people are willing to make the time. Like, these are busy people. And as soon as you mention Frank's name, they're like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. No problem. And even with other people. The regulars, the people who used to go like us, people have been so generous with their time and their stories and their experiences. Like yourself, you mailed a videotape that you unearthed so that I could put the footage in the film. People like Tom from No Means No. He's going to be driving right to North Bay when we get back on Friday to do an interview with us as he's on tour.
Amazing.
Yeah. And the thing is, that stuff doesn't happen. Like, when you make a documentary, like...
Are you overwhelmed?
No. You know what? It actually gives me energy to do this, because it's like, it's bigger than me as a filmmaker. Like, this is bigger than me just making a movie. It's for... I just feel like I'm the person that's going to just put it together. But it's really everybody else's effort that's making this into something.
Did you not quit your job to keep going on this?
I did. You know what happened? I was a program coordinator for a media lab in North Bay, and I was working on a project called Digital Creator North, which is about like putting in these remote going into small northern communities, and creating media labs and community spaces. And it was going really well. But what happened was the movie became like a full-time job. And I actually had to decide, like, it was a bittersweet decision to make, because I really liked what I was doing. And I had to sort of decide, like, I'm going to have to do this full-time for a while and become a full-time filmmaker.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing that you've put basically your whole life into it now, or at this point in your life. Yeah. You know, this is what you're doing. This is what it's about. How has the travel been? Like, you've been, like, all over the place for the past
bunch of years. And we've been traveling for the last two summers. And then in between then, we've been doing interviews sporadically throughout. It's been a lot of gear, and it's been a lot of stairs, and it's been, but you know what? It's actually, it's given me some perspective on what musicians have to go through all the time. Mm-hmm. When you have to load in gear and load gear out, and it's like, oh, I don't know, like 36 degrees and you're in an alley and you're like, then you have to go perform, or like do an interview. Like it just put in perspective what touring really was. And it made me even appreciate the musicians that I've seen even more, because they had to come to Thunder Bay to talk to, like, to play for us. Sure. And they did it. And, yeah.
Well, the road can be your best friend, or it could be your worst enemy.
Absolutely.
Right? But it's always the common goal of, you know, this is what we do, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to get it done. And when you're on stage or behind a microphone doing an interview, and you know that you have a goal to do, it's like that all kind of evaporates, right? It's just, this is the thing, you know what I mean? Yeah, every human nature, there's struggle and stuff like that. But if you love what you're doing and you have a passion behind it, then absolutely. And that's why every band, regardless of the hardships, still does it. And that's why you're still doing it, because this has become your...
I feel really lucky.
Yeah.
I do. I feel really lucky, you know? It's almost like a gift to be able to live like a life, like a creative life. Mm-hmm. And, it's like, you might think, I think with creative people, and I was talking to somebody who is an artist about this, I think most creative people or artists think that everybody can create like something from nothing. Mm-hmm. And then she kind of corrected me when I was talking about this film. I was like, well, you know, anybody could do it. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, not everybody can, you know? And I think coming from that do-it-yourself, punk rock, underground counterculture, where, you know, you were making your own posters, you were postering, you were putting on shows, you were putting money together to make albums, you were making t-shirts in your garage. Like, there, I think I owe a lot to that time period. Mm-hmm. And I owe a lot to that scene that helped sort of raise me and make me a person who would quit their job and devote it to making like a film about a bar in nowhere.
Oh man, it's tons of respect, you know what I mean? And I can completely relate to what you're saying, and it's that whole DIY kind of mentality, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, yeah, you might never play Wembley Stadium, but you put in the work and you get, you know, you put out what you need to put out for people and for yourself, and it does get recognized. And sometimes the people it does get recognized by are the ones you want to recognize it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's all about those relationships too.
Absolutely.
Like, that's what a scene is, you know? And I think when I was talking to Brent Linton, he's a photographer that's actually donated 1,500 photographs to our production that we can use. He used to go to every show and he used to take photos of every band that ever played. And he used to say too, like, the thing that was so special about Crocs, because he came from a larger center and he came from a pretty intense punk rock scene from the city he was from. Mm-hmm. The thing about the Thunder Bay thing that was different was that we all kind of liked each other. We might not have liked the kinds of music that everyone liked. Like, not everyone was into hardcore punk rock music. Not everybody was into Celtic, you know, jam bands. But when we all got together, it didn't matter what the genre was. We all sort of just supported everyone. And we supported our local bands, too. And that's something that resonated with him coming from a scene outside of Thunder Bay, mm-hmm. which I thought was kind of enlightening when I was talking to him because not every scene's like that. So there's something special that was happening in Thunder Bay, and there was a respect, I think, between the people who came through the door. It was like if you walked through those doors, those big kind of, they look like dungeon doors or whatever for that club. When, as soon as you walk through there, there was a level of respect that everyone gave one another. And whether you were a tree planter or a punk rock kid or, you know, a university Celtic loving, you know, band loving person or whatever, you were just sort of like accepted. And I think for a lot of us, we didn't get that acceptance.
Yeah, it's hard in everyday life, whether you're in school or just out and about with like people, especially back in that time too. It's like you look at like nowadays where like bullying is a huge thing and just like fitting in and whatnot. Earlier in the late 80s, early 90s, to have a place like that where you could go to and just be so comfortable and accepted and just know that you could go up to anybody and be like, hey, do you like the band? Or hey, what's up? And stuff like that. And the other person will respond back, great. You know what I mean? That was very, very important in just like the upbringing of just anybody growing up, right? And I feel very, very fortunate that Crocs and Rolls was there.
Yeah.
Because of that. And as we talked about in when we the other interview for the documentary, which we did earlier, it's just like it reflects a lot of the way my mindset of today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like at 44, I'm still doing what I do because I love to do it. You know what I mean? And a lot of those values were instilled in me when I was younger because you're very impressionable. And I'm very thankful that I had that environment to instill those values in me. And I still carry them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yeah.
You know?
And what was really cool about Thunder Bay was we weren't just being influenced by the bands that came through. Like, of course we were. We were there to see the music. But we kind of like influenced each other. We talked to Renee and David. They run Definitely Superior in Thunder Bay.
Okay.
It's a artist run art gallery. And they've been doing that for many years. And the thing about Renee, I don't know if you remember her. She's like gorgeous, red hair, was at every show. She was just like, she was kind of like my Madonna. Like I wanted to be her so bad. When I talked to her about that experience, she was like, well, we were all sort of being influenced by everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, there was...
like a community. It was a community.
Yeah. And I think, like, I don't know what it is. I don't, like I said before in the interview that we did before, I'm not a Luddite. Like, I love technology. Mm-hmm. But there is something that's changed a bit. And maybe I talked to Frank a couple of weeks ago about this, too, about curiosity. Like that curiosity to just kind of like not have to know everything in advance, but just kind of showing up to life. That seems to be like something that's kind of like I'm holding my phone right now in my hand. Like it seems to be something that like is missing. And I remember like getting just information back then, like it took a lot of work.
Yeah.
Like you had to really work for everything, what you wore, what you listened to, what you watched.
Well, you touched on St. James Music at one point when we were talking over the last like 5 hours, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's like if you wanted to find a band, you'd have to like research it somehow, like, and you'd have to hear about it, or you'd pick up like a fanzine or something like that, or you'd see a band and then you'd go to like St. James Stereo and you had to like order it.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny.
And then you wait 8 weeks.
Yeah. And it's like, and maybe, and you'd go back and be like, is it in yet? Not yet. But it's amazing that we grew up in a period where we didn't have that instant gratification or instant whatever, you know what I mean? And
when my niece and nephew asked me what it was like back then before the internet, and these conversations do come up at like family dinners, I tell the same story. Okay, so this is what it was like growing up in 1989. I'm watching Much Music. There's a band getting interviewed and the drummer is wearing a Love and Rockets comic book t-shirt.
Right.
Okay. I become obsessed with the shirt, but because I'm not videotaping it or TiVoing it and I don't have a computer.
TiVo. What the fuck is TiVo?
What was that? I don't know what this is. So I assume that it is some sort of comic book because it's a comic. Mm. So I go down to the local comic book shop and I talk to the guy who runs the shop, and through like 35-40 minutes of description, he figures out that it's the Love and Rockets comic book, gives me it. I take it home. I open up the front page, find the address and phone number to the Fantagraphic office, call the secretary, and because she doesn't have a catalog, she has to ask me. Okay, I go, okay, so this is what I did. Mm-hmm. Called the secretary of the publishing house, talked to her for about, I don't know, 20 minutes or so. She says, okay, can you describe the shirt? And I'm like, okay, so it's white and it's a red design and it has two girls on it playing guitar and they're wearing plaid shirts. So she figures out what comic book it is, asks me what the size is, then goes like, well, how are you going to pay for this? I'm like, I don't know. So my dad's standing in the kitchen in his underwear, like doing the dishes. And I go, Dad, can I have your credit card? So my dad gets on the phone and talks to the secretary of the publishing place and gives him his credit card information. And 8 weeks later, the shirt shows up in the mail.
Was it the right one?
It was the right one.
Nice.
It was a nice size. And I tell you, like, I wore that shirt till it fell off. And I will always remember that shirt and I will never replace it. But it means more to me than anything I've ever bought on Amazon in my entire life.
Because of the legwork you had to put in. And yeah. I respect that. I respect that.
That was that's a lot to get a shirt.
That's a great story. And that's not just a great story, but it's a great example of how not difficult. Well, yes, difficult.
It was hard.
At the time. You know what I mean? You couldn't just pull up the old answer box and, you know.
Oh, yeah. Or I would listen to, there's a scene called Ben is Dead. Mm-hmm. And they later went on to be, I think they started Bitch Magazine or Bust Magazine. I can't remember which one.
Okay.
I remember them getting interviewed by Brent Bambury on CBC Radio 3. Because I couldn't stay up that late. So I would put a tape in my stereo and I would record.
The radio?
The radio.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I would record Brave New Waves, which was on late at night on the CBC. Mm-hmm. And then I would listen to the tape on my Walkman on the bus to school. So he was interviewing.
Amazing.
Yeah. So he was interviewing Ben is Dead, these women who did the zine. And I just sort of, you know, got their address. So they said, if anybody wants to buy our zine, here's our address. Wrote them basically what was a love letter to them and what I thought, like, I thought they were really cool ladies. And they ended up sending me, like, I don't know, their back catalog. And
like fan club stuff, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Wanted no money for it. They threw in a t-shirt and stickers and just wrote me a beautiful 3-page letter that I still have today. Mm-hmm. And that was just like how it was back then. Mm-hmm. But I kind of miss those days where you would show up to a venue and not know who was going to be playing, mm-hmm. and just be blown away by what you were seeing.
For sure.
Like, that's how I saw DOA and SNFU, and it's how I discovered, you know, Bob's Your Uncle and all these bands that were just so, I don't know, that changed me.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, like, or makes you appreciate how much, like, touring bands had to, like, how much work they had to do just to go across Canada. You know what I mean?
And all that sort of research that they had to do, and they had to reach out to like college radio stations, and they had to, you know, get on the telephone and call venues. And one interesting thing that came up when we were talking to a lot of the West Coast bands is that, you know, it was very much like they would send people out. So SNFU and DOA would go out and they would tour and they would come back with information and tell the new bands that were coming up and ready to tour where they could go. And that's how information was sort of traded between these bands and connected everybody across Canada.
It was also someone, I remember when I was a kid, where someone would have like an SNFU tape and you'd borrow it.
Yeah.
And you'd go home and you'd like dub it. You'd record it on your dual deck super high quadraphonic sound boombox.
You're fancy.
And then you'd have to give that back, right? Then you'd have this crappy, because it would always dilute the quality a bit, but you'd have it, right?
You'd have it.
Yeah, it was like tape trading and stuff.
Or your one friend who had a job at McDonald's who could afford to buy stuff would make you mixtapes, and you would like...
Mixtapes.
Yeah, so you would have like just like a little bit of a taste. So they'd make you compilations. And then that's how you would discover your music. And I still have a lot of those from friends that used to...
Your old mixtapes?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Oh, yeah. I have my friend. I had a friend named Tanya. She was the only one out of us who had a job. So she would buy all our music and then spend hours and days and weekends putting together these mixtapes for us, just so we could have like music to listen to. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a sweetness there, you know, there's a caring, there's a I got your back thing that I kind of miss now, you know.
Yeah, for sure. No, I get it. I remember I had mixtapes, crazy mixtapes. I just borrow stuff and record it, or someone would give me a mixtape and I'd record the mixtape, which had already been recorded.
Exactly.
And, you know, you'd be listening to this crappy quality sound stuff, but you'd find bands, and it was just all part of that era. It was part of that time. Exactly. And yeah, it was a lot of legwork, but fuck, was it worth it, right?
It was,
and
it, really
you made
worth
it, made you appreciate so much.
Yeah. And also too, like, a lot of my collection, my record collection, came from the bands who had played there. Like, you would, So I remember, like, the Rio Statics came to Thunder Bay. I was, like, at that show that was a snowstorm, and there was, like, maybe 15 people there, and they just looked like they were from a different planet. They looked different. They dressed different. They seemed taller than every, like, I don't know if it's the mill that causes everybody to be 5'6" in Thunder Bay, but everyone in Thunder Bay is 5'6", and these guys look like giants. And then they got up on stage and they played the most incredible, weird music. Because before then, music to me was about, like, pissing off your parents and being angry, or it was a antithesis to something. Like, I was fighting against something. But when the Rio Statics played, it changed how I appreciated music. Music became so much more, right? It became something different than what I had experienced previous to that. And then after I have that life-changing experience, I have to go talk to Martin Tielli, who is selling tapes off the stage, and, like, try to keep my shit together. Like, but that's how you got your information. That's how you met, course, these people. Yeah. And it switched, you know. And I'm not gonna, like, I'll admit to you, like, seeing how they dress, like, I was wearing, like, jean jackets after that, and
for,
like,
sure,
fedoras, like, because I wanted to be like the Rio Statics so bad.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, it was like, it made you brave, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, you weren't, like, it wasn't the internet today where you're just, like, completely bombarded with, like, a million different things. You could, like, actually carve out, like, an identity instead of being, like, this mash of everything else. You know what I mean? It was
absolutely
just like, this is what I like, and this is what I've put in the work to like, and whatever.
And there's no way a YouTube clip of, like, a band playing is ever going to be,
yeah,
as good as seeing them live.
No, never. Live bands live music is the best thing in the world.
It really is.
Especially when you, you know, you place like Crocs and Rolls. What I touched on earlier, when SNFU played, and I actually, like, went up to Mr. Tripig and said, "Hey, Ken, how's it going?" And he's like, "Fuck you." And I'm like, "You're the greatest fucking guy that I've ever," you know what I mean? You can't beat that shit.
No, you can't.
So let's play another song. Okay. Your choice this time.
Well, let's play something by the Rio Statics, if we can.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to pick, like, it's The Wreck of Edmund Fitzgerald, because I'll tell you a little backstory.
All right, let's do
Dave
it.
Dave Bedini told me that they, the first show that they ever played, the first place they ever played outside of Toronto, was Thunder Bay. It was their first stop on their tour. And because they were coming to Thunder Bay, the whole band learned how to play that Edmund Fitzgerald song.
It's Gordon Lightfoot, and
yes,
it's Canadiana,
yeah,
to the best,
so,
at its best.
Yeah, so they rehearsed for weeks to try to get it down, and they wanted to play it in Thunder Bay. And then it ended up being on, like, Whale Music and stuff like that. So I would love to hear, like, the Rio Statics.
Okay, this is the Rio Statics. This is The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. This is Ego and Vice.
Legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they called Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more, Then the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and crew was a bone to be chewed. In the gales of November come early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and a captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms, a couple of steel firms, and it left fully loaded for Cleveland. Later that night, when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd be feeling? The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound as a wave broke. Every man knew, as the captain did too, was the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late, the breakfast had to wait, the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind. Supper time came, the old cook came on deck, saying, "Fellas, it's too rough to feed you." At 7 p.m., a main hatchway caved in. He said, "Fellas, it's been good to know you." The captain wired in, he had water coming in. Good ship and crew was in peril. Later that night, when the lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Does anyone know where the love of God goes? The searchers all say they'd have made Whitefish Bay. They'd put 15 more miles behind her. They might have split up, or they might have capsized. They may have broke deep, took water. All that remains is the faces and the names of the wives, the sons, the daughters. Water mansions. Old Michigan steams like a young person's dreams. The islands and bays are for sportsmen. And farther below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. Iron boats go, as the mariners all know, with the gales of November. Remember her. We'll be right back. musty old hall in Detroit they prayed. At the Maritime Sailors' Cathedral, the church bell chimed till it rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Lake Superior, it is said, never gives up her dead. When the gales of November come thoroughly.
Legend lives on from the Chippewa down the big lake they called Gitche-Gumee. I love it.
It's great. It's so, where we're from, man.
So the Crocs and Rolls documentary. Are you almost done?
Well, we have one more summer of doing production, so interviews. We're currently in...
You mean this summer or next summer?
This summer.
Oh, this summer.
This is
okay.
It. Yep. And then we're currently also simultaneously doing post-production at the same time. So we're editing as we are making the movie at the same time.
Okay.
And the film is scheduled to be in the can, finished in spring of 2019.
Very good.
We're hoping to... do the independent filmmaker thing, try to get it into some film festivals, doing community screenings across Canada. One idea that I had that I really hope that we can do this is showing the film once we do festivals, showing the film and doing community screenings at local independent small venues that are across Canada.
Nice.
That would be my dream, honestly.
You got to come back through Ottawa and try and get into the Mayfair Theater.
Okay, I will.
It's just up here on Bank Street. It's like a really old movie theater, but they show a lot of independent stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not like today where you sit in like the recliners with the button and
stuff.
It's like the old school theater. You can buy popcorn and stuff.
Absolutely.
Definitely. I'll try and get some information for you about the Mayfair, and I'll just send it to you, and maybe you can use it in the future.
I would love that. Thanks so much.
Yeah. But as far as the documentary, amazing work. Incredible.
Thanks.
What you've taken just from an idea to where you are now.
Yeah.
And you guys should be really, really proud of yourselves for as much legwork and as much time you've put into it. And
thanks, Mike.
And the people you've talked to. And I can't wait to, a year from now, sit down somewhere and watch it. And I'll shove popcorn in my face and it'll bring a tear to my eye. And I'll say, hey, there it is.
There you are. You're in it.
Yeah. So how about that day? What do you think about that?
Well, you know what? It's kind of like, it's hilarious because doing something, I've never done anything this big before. All my other documentaries have been really like small crew, small stories. I feel a great deal of responsibility to everybody who, to Frank for sure, but also to everybody who's ever loved that place. And some people think that that's like a pressure, that you might feel like pressure, you know, but for me, like, it's like everybody has my back about this film.
Of course.
And it's like everybody kind of wants to see it. And it just kind of like, it's like you're never out of that scene. You're never out of that world. And I feel like a great deal of love and support. And I'm going to try my best to make everybody proud when they see it.
I think they are going to be proud of you. And it's been documented. And that's the most important thing. The story was told. Who cares what people, you know, naysayers or whatever? It doesn't matter. The people that were involved are the ones that are going to really, really appreciate it. And the people that don't know anything about it, they're going to be informed.
Yeah, for sure.
And this is a story that needs to be told. And you're doing it.
Oh, thanks, Mike. I've always had this. I had two visions for this film, but what it would look like when it was done. Mm-hmm. The one was you find kind of like a videotape like yours in the back of a closet. And it's like you're discovering.
Covered in wax
and discovering something new. And the other thing I kind of want to do is I saw this film a little bit like a old school coffee table book where every story is pulled together, all the photos and you know, people's lives are sort of documented in this one sort of thing. And like I said, like this, I'm just making the film. Like I don't feel an ownership to it because it's everybody's story and everybody has helped so much. So it really is a collaborative effort. And I think that speaks a lot to that time, that scene, coming up and just being like a music lover. And it speaks to Frank because Frank Lofredo really did sort of beat the path for a lot of us. And whatever sense of community I have, and you know, in my day job I devote it to helping kids discover art. That's all a direct reflection
inspired by him.
Yeah, so I see it as everybody's film. It's our project, really.
Great. That's inspiring, and thanks. It is commendable, and I know it's going to be an amazing film.
Oh, thanks, Mike.
Your drive is, I can see the passion in you. I know you want to do it because you want to do it, and you guys are all going to be fucking better off because you know about Crocs and motherfucking rolls. I want to end this off saying thank you so much. Oh. It was an honor finally sitting down with you.
It's great meeting you in person.
It was a privilege to sit down and be interviewed by you for the film. Thanks. And even if I just make like 10 seconds of it, I'm good. The final thing I want to ask you is, yes, I know this is a film about Crocs and Rolls, a documentary about Crocs and Rolls, but as you've touched on throughout this podcast, you have a very fond connection with Frank. If you had one thing to say to Frank right now, what would it be?
You know what? He's a really humble guy. So anything I say, he's going to roll his eyes at.
His eyes roll.
Yeah. I would like to just say, you know, he made Thunder Bay a place where he let us be proud of where we were from. And I mean, if you think about what Thunder Bay was like in the 80s, you know, redneck kind of Dukes of Hazzard kind of town. He made us feel proud of where we came from, and having that confidence in where you're from and what you're doing with your life, especially at a really impressionable age, like that's like handing a kid a key to like discovering themselves. And you know what's hilarious is like Frank was always encouraging the kids who came through that club to like do something with their lives. And I joke with him all the time. Like, I'm like, Frank, you're still helping me out. Like, you're letting me tell your story. And all the people from that community are helping contribute to the film. Like, it's just like he's still doing it for me as that kid at 14. And now I'm 44. Like, he's still 44. Helping us out, you know, and he's still absolutely. Being an example after all these years.
We're gonna make it.
you want to get a hold of me, you can always contact me at eagleandvice@gmail.com. If you want to listen to the podcasts, you can go to eagleandvice.com. Did I just say that? Anyway. I'm on iTunes. You can listen to the podcast on Facebook. I'm on Podomatic. You name it. It's there. So, cool, man. That was great. What a great trip down memory lane with Kirsten talking about Crocs and Rolls. Yeah, so this was episode 38 of Ego and Vice. Only two more episodes until my season finale, and then I'm taking a break for a few months. So thanks for showing up, and I'll see you on the other side.
You've got a real attitude problem, McFly. You're a slacker.